Welcome to Shetland with Laurie, a podcast dedicated to Shetland, the place and the people, with me, Laurie Goodland, a writer and tour guide based at 60 degrees north. The Shetland with Laurie podcast is for people who have visited Shetland, or who would like to visit, or for those who would just like to know a little bit more about life here. So welcome, I'm so glad you're here. Today I'm chatting to Alexa Fitzgibbon, who is an amazingly talented photographer, weaver, designer and social anthropologist, who first came to Shetland 12 years ago from France to study. She has since moved here and has become a very close friend of mine. So in this episode we chat about her studies on religion in the North Atlantic area and the relationships between the living and the dead. And as we're approaching Halloween, we hear about some of Shetland's ghostly tales that she uncovered during her research and the burden of Protestant guilt that sometimes lives on in the lives of many Shetlanders, myself included, today. Alexa is a photographer, and we speak about her photos and her love of portrait photography and capturing moments with people. She also spends several days a week working as a weaver for the Shetland Tweed Company, where she designs and produces woven cloths inspired by Shetland's landscape and the seasons. So she explains how she became a weaver and the intricacies involved in producing these bespoke cloths. We also chat about another one of her many projects, which is creating Kakeshi dolls. Kakeshi dolls are Japanese wood-turned dolls that are engraved and painted with bright and colourful designs. Alexa began creating these at home during lockdown and she now sells bespoke, one-of-a-kind commissions all over the world. And it's amazing how they've taken off in just these few short months. So she talks us through the process of creating them and where she finds her creative energy and inspiration from. So I'm really excited about today's show and I hope that you enjoy listening as much as I enjoyed recording it. So let's just dive right in and say hello to Alexa. Hi Alexa, thank you for joining me on today's show.
Hi, thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Listen Alexa, we're really good friends in real life, so it feels a bit strange actually interviewing you, so hopefully it doesn't feel too formal.
Yes, definitely.
So I've known you now for, what is it, maybe, yeah, 4 years.
Four years, yeah.
Actually, it just came up in my Facebook memories like a couple of days ago. So yeah, we're 4 year friendship anniversary. So happy anniversary.
Happy anniversary. It feels longer than that. But
but for those who don't know who you are, could you just kind of tell us a little bit about yourself and what it is that you do?
So I'm actually French. Well, my father is English, but I was born in France.
So bonjour.
Bonjour. I've been in Shetland, well, coming to Shetland for over 12 years now, but actually living, I can't really tell because I was just going back and forth. Originally, I came for my studies. I was studying social anthropology and I had picked Shetland as my fieldwork because I was working on religion in the North Atlantic area. That's the area I wanted to work on. And then I saw Shetland on the map and I thought, I want to go there.
So it was your studies that brought you up here. So yes. can you tell us what it was that you were kind of studying and what you found most fascinating when you started doing your research? Because obviously you came to Shetland probably not knowing a whole lot about the place, but you got to know the community really quite well.
Yes. Well, I was doing my master's degree and I actually spent my first year, because we do masters in 2 years in France. Mm-hmm. I spent my very first year reading everything I possibly could on Shetland, which ended up not being as much as I expected, obviously. Yeah. But I went to London and to London Library and I just checked out every single book that had an article or anything written about Shetland. So when I came here, I knew some of it and it just felt really strange because I had had those islands in my head for a whole year reading about Yell, Unst, Fetlar, anything that I could find. And then I was finally there. So I remember it being a really strange feeling.
Was it what you expected when you got here?
Yes and no. It was a really eerie feeling. I remember driving in the fog from Sumber Airport. I was being picked up by Lawrence, who became one of my very best friend, really.
Yeah.
And just looking at the landscape, thinking this is how I pictured it, but at the same time, it was just so different and so beautiful that it was just quite different, really. It was entirely different
Yeah.
from what I was used to. And yeah, just the place and the people. I didn't know what to expect from people. I was expecting them to be friendly, but I mean, it was just the beginning of the journey, so.
Yeah. And so what kind of strands did you pick up when you got here in terms of the study? What was it that you were really looking at and trying to find while you were here?
I was actually studying relationship between the living and the dead, which might sound a bit strange said like this. But I wanted to see how people's relationship with, whether it was ancestors, ghost, just heritage in general, was affecting their relationship with this, was affecting the way they were building their identity in the present. So I had read a lot about ghost stories in Shetland, and I was thinking I was going to work on folklore, but then I actually ended up meeting quite a few people that had seen ghosts or had lived with ghosts. So that ended up being quite a big part of my research. Now, at that stage, most people ask me, "Do you believe in ghosts? Do you have you seen a ghost?"
Do you?
Well, I always try to explain to people that my purpose was never to actually do ghost hunting or to prove that ghosts exist. As long as ghosts exist for someone else, then they had an impact in their life. So I was studying the impact. So how people build themselves, relate to their houses, to their family. And then I was trying to identify a pattern to see if there was a similar response in other people that were seeing ghosts, which there was. So it was really interesting to see how those patterns were standing out and to try and explain why and how with the cultural and religious background.
So while you were here, you spent quite a bit of time up in the North Isles, and you stayed with Lawrence up in Yell. And it's interesting because when I was up in Yell last summer, then we stayed in a kind of holiday let in Yell, and I went for a walk somewhere, and I felt, I'm not saying I believe in ghosts, but I definitely felt there was like a presence, or there was something. There was a house that I got to that I couldn't bring myself, it was like a ruined house, I couldn't bring myself to like step over the threshold and go inside. And we were there with the children, and we were going to have a picnic, and I felt that we had to leave. And I remember speaking to you about that area, and that was an area where you had interviewed somebody that had reported like ghost stories. So
Yes.
so you'll have collected quite a number of these stories. And for me, I just found it fascinating that I was in that place and I felt such a strong sense that I shouldn't be there. And then I spoke to you and you could tell me about the ghost that was said to haunt it.
Yes. It's a particular area in Yale that is supposed to be quite haunted, and it has a lot of, even in the in actual stories, Shetland stories, which are not necessarily based on facts or things that really happened, but just folk tales, that actually has also some stories, some ghost stories. But it was really interesting that you felt this way, the same way that I spoke to people had felt also this way, because it sorts of binded into the whole pattern that I had already observed, and that was 10 years ago. So it was quite nice to see that it was still relevant to today.
And so do you think that Shetland has more of these kind of ghost stories and more kind of supernatural tales, or are we just the same as everywhere else?
No, you are the same, I would say, as Nordic countries. A big part of my research, and I was working with researchers that were working in Siberia, in Norway, Faroe Island, Iceland, And we were comparing with the South as well. So some islands in the Pacific and some African countries. And one thing that actually stands out from all those research is that Nordic country or Protestant countries actually are ghost societies. We call them ghost societies, whereas Catholic based country are not really ghost societies. So, and we were trying to figure out why, because in the Nordic world, in Icelandic tales, in Shetland folklore, and even in English or Irish, then you see quite a lot of those tales with ghosts, spirits, you have banshees, whereas it doesn't really appear so much in Catholic countries like France, Italy. You do have some ghost stories, but it's not felt the same and it's not imprinted the same in those cultures.
Okay.
And part of our research determined that the bottom line was actually when Protestants decided to separate from the notion of purgatory, because in Catholic countries you have the purgatory. So when you die, you go to heaven, to hell, or you go to purgatory to make up for your sins. So you stay a certain amount of time in purgatory before you can get to heaven. If you behave well, then you can go out. Whereas Protestant countries do not have purgatory anymore, because it was a way for authorities to stop basically the church from taking money out of people, because they were getting money to get their loved ones out of purgatory. So by removing purgatory, then the church could not take advantage of people anymore. So basically you had to do good your entire life and you would go to heaven, or I would say more likely, because it's impossible to follow exactly what the Bible says into being good, you would more likely go to hell. So that's when ghosts actually sort of separated from religion and was part of the world. So I was speaking to a lot of people who were speaking about ghosts and at the same time were very religious, and I couldn't figure out how that could work.
Yeah, because they don't really kind of marry together in the conventional sense.
No, definitely not.
We would think anyway.
There shouldn't be any ghost technically if people either go to heaven or to hell. So that's when I started seeing that some ghosts were actual spirits, some ghosts were just memories that were imprinted in a house or a space that was basically reenacted when the right conditions were put together.
Mm-hmm.
So say someone died on a foggy day at this specific time of the night. Then on a foggy day at this specific time of the night, it's like the world merged together and then this memory is reenacted and you would see this person.
It's fascinating. And actually, I'm just thinking that when this podcast is released, it'll be into October and it's probably going to be nearly around about Halloween time.
So perfect.
I wasn't going to ask you this, but while I've got you, what's your kind of favourite Shetland ghost story that you came across? I'm putting you on the spot.
Yes. I suppose it would probably be, it's not actually a folk tale, it's an actual ghost that has lived with a family, and he was called Willie.
Mm-hmm.
And supposedly that house was built from, what's the name? I should know that name. Windhouse?
Oh, Windhouse up in Yell.
Up in Yell, yes. So some of the stones from Windhouse were used to build that particular house. And Windhouse is supposed to be one of the most haunted houses in the whole of UK.
Indeed.
And as it turned out, in a lot of stories, you can carry ghosts with pieces of the place they're supposed to live in. So he was carried with those stones. He was just transferred from one house to the other. And he was living with the family. And they have seen him, or more like seen his manifestation. He was quite the protector ghost, because it's not very often I found a malicious ghost really in Shetland. Most of the time it is someone that's here that appears, manifests itself from now and again, and actually makes you feel like you're not on your own. And she had this feeling. Her husband was going at sea very often, so she was alone with her children in the house quite often. And it was at the time where there was no mobile phone, no internet, so it was a different sort of isolation. And she said she never felt scared in this house in any way, because she knew he was there and she knew that if anything was to happen, then he would wake her up or he would actually intervene. And I always thought that was quite a nice story. And it's not the only protector that I found in Shetland. There was quite a few stories with ghosts looking after children or stopping them from falling down the stairs or going down the stairs, or which was always quite nice.
Yeah. So less the scary ghouls that we might think about, and more just a kind of positive energy around families.
And as a general rule, it sort of appeared that what you would call unhappy houses, as opposed to happy houses, would gradually be left anyway. So say something happened in the house and this house was just cursed, or if there was a positive energy that could take over, then this house would continue to be inhabited and would just build up that positive energy. Whereas a house that was called unlucky, and people, the same feeling that you described when you were in that place.
Feeling
like you didn't want to be there, that you're, it's a bit like death took over in those areas and you have ruins that can give that sort of feeling, and they will never be inhabited, or not in the near future anyway, and they end up just being left. Whereas those particular houses that carry a positive energy, that even if they have a ghost or presence or some kind of trace, then people are not scared and people actually feel safe in them. So, so yes, they will just keep living there.
Certainly after being in that house in Yell and feeling that energy, I never saw a ghost, but just that sense that I really shouldn't be there, I can certainly kind of understand where you're coming from. And you do hear about people speaking about like a happy house, or that was an unhappy house, and it's definitely a feeling rather than anything.
Yes, it is described as a feeling, and some people describe like the feeling is really strong when you start wanting to go inside the house. I have had some people tell me I couldn't go inside this house, I just didn't want to, I just didn't feel right. Mm-hmm. When people are buying houses, for example, or it's a very strong feeling. So, and I mean, sometimes you look at the history of this house and there's nothing, you can't really see anything particular that happened there. And other time you see in a happy house, something quite, that can be seen as quite bad or quite strong or quite negative happened there. And yet it didn't actually take over.
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily to do with what happened. It has to do with something that builds up, really, and the feeling that people feel when they get there.
And do you feel that when you're in houses?
I suppose I do now. I started being aware of it because after people telling me about all this, you always start thinking about, well, how do I feel about this myself when I walk inside a house? And yes, I mean, I have never interpreted it as a happy house or a bad house, but there's definitely places that I walk into and it feels homely, friendly, cozy, and then other places where I would walk into and feel like, oh, I don't really like being here. So
yeah, and you can never quite put your finger on it.
No, I wasn't aware until I actually spoke to people about it.
And that's another thing, actually, while we're speaking about while you were living up in the North Isles, you were staying with Lawrence, and he was one of Shetland's great storytellers. So that must have been incredible learning from Lawrence.
Yes.
He wrote a book which you illustrated, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes because it's a fantastic book about Shetland folklore.
Yes, he does. He used to tell, so many stories, was internationally recognised for his storytelling all over the world as well, for representing Shetland. So, and I mean, not just this, but he was just a mine of information and for Shetland. He used to say that he was not knowledgeable, but he was probably one of the most knowledgeable person I've met. He was very humble.
Yeah, very modest man.
Very modest. I mean, he always said, I left school when I was 14. I was not very, very clever. He just really was.
Yeah.
Yes, I used to. We used to have St Kilda Parliament with Lawrence every when I stayed, which was a joke because it was basically sitting for sometimes up to 3-4 hours talking with a cup of tea, just talking about Shetland and life in general and just rethinking the whole universe. And like they used to do in St Kilda Parliament, just talking, but never getting to any sort of conclusion.
So for anybody that's listening that doesn't know, then St Kilda is Scotland or Britain's most westerly island, and it was abandoned in the 1930s.
But the
people of the village used to meet every day, and they would call it the St Kilda Parliament, where they would meet and have a cup of tea and just kind of yarn or speak about things and what was important, and not really getting anything done, but just having a good old chat.
Yeah, I think it was meant to be the direction the day was supposed to take. What has to be done. But in the end, it was just really getting nowhere, but just a nice big chat.
Yeah. Today you stay in Vaux, which is kind of getting up into the North Mainland of Shetland. And you wear quite a number of hats as well. So you've got quite a few different jobs and things that keep you busy. So I thought we would start with photography. So you're a fantastic photographer and you're completely self-taught photographer.
Yes, I am a self-taught photographer. I started taking photos when I was, probably when I was about 13. I was given my first camera then. And then I got my first digital camera, because that was film then. I got my first digital camera when I was 18. And it just started this way, really. And I used to go around and take pictures every day of literally everything. But my main subject was really people. I just love taking natural photos of candid photography of people just having real moments and portraits. So, I then had my first DSLR about over 10 years ago now. At first I was taking photos for friends, and then I had friends who got married and asked me if I could be their wedding photographer. And it just all started like this.
That's right. You were my wedding photographer too.
Yes.
So it's kind of people generally that you photograph. When I'm looking at your pictures, then I always feel that you get the kind of sense of drama and the mood and the light. That's just fantastic. So is Shetland a good place for photography?
Oh, definitely. A lot of people think that with photography backgrounds is the most important, or you know, you take, this is a nice place, let's take a nice picture. But I always felt that it's not so much the background than the light, the way you use the light. So sometimes the most random background can actually give the most beautiful picture. That's not speaking about landscape photography, by the way. Yes, Shetland has this very special light. I mean, the fact that the sea and the water is always nearby, it gives a lot of reflection, so it diffuses the light very well. The hills as well, and in winter it's a very low light, so it's a difficult light sometimes to work with, but it's incredible when you actually get it right. And in summer it's quite high and it's very bright, and the fact that there's no pollution as well, because I remember in France over the summer there was always this, even on a day with bright sunshine and blue sky, there's always this sort of mist in the air, which is actually a pollution mist.
Yeah.
And that you tend to get rid of when the temperatures are going down around September.
Yeah.
And then you get that crisp light again. But in Shetland, you really get it all year round. So
what's your favorite season for photography?
Oh, it's hard to tell. I love summer, obviously, because I get to do far more. But I do love the winter light when we get a nice day, because it's impossible to take really good photos on a dark day. So I would probably say autumn and spring, because you still get this sort of low light, crisp light. It's quite strong in the summer, so in the summer you have to wait quite a while before you get it right. At the peak of the day, it's just so bright.
And that's kind of the photography that you do, is outside. So although you're photographing people, you're not doing like traditional studio photography. You're using the outdoors and you're using that natural light and space.
Yes, I don't really like studio photography. I also feel I take a lot of family photos. Children are far happier in an environment that they're familiar with, and I mean outside playing. And even parents are far more relaxed because their children are much happier, and if they need to blow off some steam, then it can blow off some steam, and then yeah. I can take photos while this is happening.
Or yeah,
it's definitely a good environment for candid photography and natural moments, really.
Yeah. And people can actually book you for photography sessions. So especially at this time of year when we're all starting to, I'm not going to say the C word, but we're starting to think about that day in December that's fast approaching. And yes. it makes a really good gift idea as well. So people can get in touch and book you for, if they're in Shetland, obviously, but they can get in touch and book you for a family photography session.
Yes. It's very easy. It's very relaxed. Obviously, we have to work around the weather. But,
yeah.
So we have to be flexible in Shetland.
But, yeah. And as well as the photography, you are also a weaver with the Shetland Tweed Company. So how did you get into weaving? And tell us a bit about that.
Well, weaving was really an opportunity. Andy, my boss, who was also a friend, got in touch with me. It was maybe three or four years ago, and asked me if I wanted to learn to weave because he thought I might be good at it, because he thought I was good at colors, at putting colors together. And I like doing decoration and interior design and things like this. And I actually did quite a lot of patchwork. So yes, he asked me if I wanted to learn. And I thought I would give it a go, but I was not entirely confident because it's actually quite, there's a lot of maths and it's quite technical, and it felt like it was a huge thing to learn suddenly without any sort of, I didn't have any background really for it. So so I started on a small loom, and then basically Andy showed me the basics, and then I read a book about how to work patterns and then colors. I had to learn as well how to put colors together. It's a bit like painting. So once I actually figured that out, then yes, I started working on the bigger loom for production. And now I actually weave and design my own cloth. So
yeah, your cloths are absolutely beautiful. And I'll share some photos in the show notes of the cloths that you have designed. But the one that you're working on at the moment, can you tell us about that and the kind of inspiration for it?
Well, every cloth is inspired by Shetland. So, yeah. I mean, I usually work from photography. I look at photos, some photos that I take. I take sometimes photos of things that I see, colors that I quite like that I see, and think, oh, that would make a nice cloth. And then I try to put all the colors together. The cloth I'm currently working on is a variation in blue going into heather. So I designed it so it would be a wave of color. So it goes into blues and then goes into lighter blues and then blends in with some heathery colors and then goes into darker heathery colors and then goes back in a sort of wave rhythm. I quite like to blend in waves because it also reminds of the whole Shetland atmosphere. And
we don't always think about weaving when we think about Shetland kind of textile heritage. We often just think about the knitwear and the knitting. So can you tell us what role weaving has had historically in Shetland?
It actually had a massive role, really. People are not entirely aware, but there was a weaving industry up until I think 60s or 70s. There was 80s in vogue, and they actually used to weave tweed for Dior and Chanel. They were making dress out of them, but I suppose because it was more seen less as a craft but more as a industry, really. Just weaving cloth for, regardless of who it was for, I guess they sort of pictured it like this. And also the fact that Shetland tweed was never recognized the same way as Harris Tweed was.
So yeah.
Harris Tweed is worldwide recognized and it's protected, and it can only, it's very, I'm not sure how you would just, what the right term is, but it's like copyrighted, really.
Yeah.
Whereas Shetland Tweed doesn't have that same recognition. And Andy is actually doing a master's degree trying to prove that the Shetland weaving had never stopped since the Viking times in Shetland, but it was done on a smaller scale inside houses. It was just done as on a family level. So you see a lot of traces of it in literature because it was part of daily life, and not so much in the archives of as such, probably because it was so much part of life that they didn't see really the point of documenting it as something special.
Yeah. I know that my great granddad, he was a weaver, and it was such a big industry. But during the 1900s and things, it very much was kind of an industry, and most of the cloth that was produced was exported away from Shetland, so less Shetland people would have been wearing the cloth that was produced here. Whereas with the knitting, they were probably wearing and selling their knitwear too.
Yes. I think because in knitting, it was, every woman in Shetland knew how to knit and was making jumpers for whoever needed jumpers, because it was just easy to do it this way. You had all the, and for some reason, weaving was more fabric, and maybe it was more considered as a luxury as well. So it was probably sent away, and not really, it was just, a work, and it was just sent away then and used.
Can I say, do you think that there was a difference between genders as well? We think of women traditionally as being the knitters, although many men did knit too. But do you think that most of the weavers were male, or do we have female weavers as well?
I wouldn't be able to reply for sure, but I think that the weavers were maybe mostly male.
Yeah.
But that's just a guess, because I've seen photos, and in the photos I've seen more men than women in on the looms. But but that's just a wild guess.
And again, the photos and the images that we see tend to be from the industrial weaving from the factories, where probably it was more men going out to work, whereas if you were weaving on a small loom at home, then we wouldn't have that same photographic evidence, and it may have been that the women were on the loom at home.
Yes, I would think they were, really, because men that would not work in an industry would probably be fishing anyway, so.
Yeah. As well as the weaving, you make dolls, and it's a special kind of doll called a Kakeshi doll, which is Japanese.
Yes.
So can you tell us about the dolls and how you got into making Japanese dolls in Shetland?
Well, I love Japanese culture. I love Japanese arts and crafts. I always have. So I have been collecting kokeshis from Japan for a good number of years. I have a small collection, not a huge collection, but a small collection. And I had always thought about making my own ones, but not for selling, just as a bit of a challenge, making my own kokeshi. And for my 30th birthday, I think, that my partner would turned a kokeshi that I could paint and engrave myself. So I did this, and I really enjoyed it. And then he told me that I would be good at making them. So I got a lathe for my birthday, a few years after that, and I made my two first one, and they were just Christmas present. I was making them for Christmas present for family. Mm-hmm. And then recently, during lockdown, I couldn't work, obviously. I was stuck at home, and I was not allowed to work. I was one of those people.
Yeah.
I thought about making one in memory of my dog, who was a Japanese Akita, who died last year. And I always wanted to make a doll with him on it. So I did this. And then I posted on Instagram and I had people get in touch with me asking me if I was selling them. So that's how I started. I made another one and then someone else got in touch and I made another one. And yes, so...
So it kind of snowballed.
Yes, it has. I actually got a message, was it yesterday, from a Kokeshi shop in France, who is an works with independent artists from Japan and also other places of the world, because I didn't know, but you can actually get recognition as a Kokeshi artist if you're not Japanese, because a Hungarian woman and a French man both got prizes for their Kokeshis.
Okay. And
she asked me if I wanted to be put in touch with them and also if I would consider potentially making a small series of Kokeshi for her for selling in her shop. So
amazing.
Yes. <Wow. laughs>
So it's grown really from just an idea that you wanted to just make this Kokeshi for yourself.
Yes.
And now you're taking commissions and hopefully stocking them in independent
yes.
retailers. So can you kind of talk us through the process of making one of these? Like what kind of wood do you use and how do you prepare it for paint?
Traditionally for Kokeshis, Japanese artists would use dogwood, which I haven't been able to really source. I'm guessing it's more native to Japan.
Yeah.
So I've been looking at places that sell wood that is actually big enough for making Kokeshis, because you have a lot of wood made for bowls and made for pen and things like this, but not so much the bigger size. So found a place in England that would do it. And I just looked at the different types of wood and tried a few ones and found that sycamore was actually quite good because the wood is quite light. So you really see the when you paint, it's like a blank canvas, really.
Yeah.
And has a nice grain as well, not too prominent, but there. So it was finding the right balance bin with all this. And I would turn them. So I can do dolls with body and head, but my favorite ones are actually oval-shaped ones, like sort of egg-shaped.
Yeah.
And because I just find them... I just find that they have a lot of soul once I make them. I find them quite... having spirit, really.
Yeah.
I find it easier to put a spirit in them. Really.
We're back in the realm of the dead now.
Yes. And so then I pencil the biggest details, really. And then I will use a pyrographer to wood burn them. So it's quite detailed and intricate, and you have to have a really steady hand, so I work on a pillow.
Okay.
Because it's not actually easy to work on a surface that you have to turn around and it's not very stable. So and after that I start the painting, and then I finish with an acrylic type of matte varnish that I have to coat quite a few times to make it look good. And it's a varnish that I have tested in the past when I was making small jewelry on painted wood, and it can resist a lot of sunlight, so I have tested it so that I know it can handle sunlight and protect the paint. Because a lot of the trouble with Kokeshis, older Kokeshis that you find, is that they become yellow once they are exposed too much to sunlight.
Yeah,
it's just the varnish getting yellow. So,
and you would expect, listening to you speaking and speaking about the processes of how you create them and how you and just when people see the images and the art that go on to the Kokeshis, you would expect that you would be trained or have gone to art school, but you again are completely self-taught.
Yes, I didn't know how to use a lathe. I was basically shown how to put the wood on the lathe. My partner showed me that, and then I just played with the chisels and then realized which ways you're supposed to do it. I should probably say I watch lots of YouTube videos, but I'm one of those people that can't actually do things like this. I don't know why, but I really struggle to actually learn things from YouTube and sit there and look at. I'm really not a digital technology person. I just do things, and then I learn from my mistakes, and then I just you know, make it differently if it doesn't work. And that's really how I figure things out. So
Good old
That's how I work.
Trial and error.
I always stop and think, oh, well, I should probably try and do this because it sounds really nice. And then I just try and learn and just, yeah, trial it. That's how I started doing patchwork. My friend Margaret showed me the basics, and I wasn't really into making geometrical patchwork. I wanted to make actual scenes. So I drew a scene, and then I cut it into angular shapes, which made really little shapes, and then I built up an entire scene like a painting, like I would have done with a painting.
Yeah,
that's how I like to do it. So I just did it like that.
Always, whenever we speak, I'm always just blown away with like how creative you are and how you can like turn your hand to anything, whether it's photography or art or, you know, you just seem to pick it up. But have you always been creative? Have you always had this kind of creative flair? And is it something that you displayed when you were young, or is it something that you've picked up in adulthood?
I suppose I was always a bit like this. I mean, I was a tomboy and I loved DIY, building things. So I used to build stuff in the garden. I was getting my mum was getting crazy because she was getting really mad because I used to just build cabins over cabins in the garden, and I used nails, and I was just building so many things in the garden. And she then, obviously winter came and they just all fell down and it was just a pile of junk, and then I would start building the next one. So she was getting desperate. But I was drawing quite a lot, and then I actually stopped. I used to draw a lot when I was in high school, and then I stopped because I had a friend who is an amazing comic illustrator, and it just was so hard to actually draw anything when he was next to you, because you felt he was doing a masterpiece when you were doing something. So I started drawing again when Lawrence asked me, because he knew I had been drawing, and he asked me if I would make illustration for his books. So that's when I started drawing again. And then I basically draw this pretty much the same way as I would draw my illustration on my dolls, which is why they're a bit different than traditional kokeshis, because kokeshi will have a sort of repeat pattern, floral pattern mainly. Yeah. And they rarely have scenes, whereas I actually use the kimono on the doll, and I create a story with the different panels, and I make proper illustration inside the on the doll. So that's a bit different from traditional kokeshis.
Yeah, so they're telling a complete story just in like the illustrations alone.
Yes, I combine elements. So if I want, sometimes it actually shows a scene, but other times it represents a place. Like the last one I made is based on California poppy fields, all those those very bright orange fields, and there's a raccoon, there's a squirrel, monarch butterflies, and it just all sort of binds together with the colors, and it actually tells the story, a story for the person that commissioned it, because it's part of elements of her life that she likes, and things that she animals that comes into her garden, or there's little things just hidden in the middle.
Yeah, so if people were looking to commission you to make a kokeshi doll, then you would, I suppose, have a conversation with them and find out what it is that they like, and then build their doll uniquely around what it is that's important to them.
Yes, I will ask for sometimes for specific details, or if they want a certain type of atmosphere, because some might be after a night atmosphere, or others, like my next one is, I think she's in New York, and she wanted a phoenix and a sort of symbol of renaissance. And but she said that for everything else, she wanted me to decide what to do, because she wanted to give me the freedom of putting the phoenix in something that I could picture, really, which can make my job easier, because I actually see it in my head, and I just try to reproduce what I see in my head on the doll. Really, that's how I work.
And where do you get your inspiration from? Where's your creativity come from?
Inspiration. I don't really know how to answer to this because I get those images in my head. I guess it comes from a bit everything. Things that I see, art that I have, just things that videos that I will see of films, or it comes from everywhere, and I just have these images that come into my head, and I hadn't seen those poppy, well, I think I had seen those poppy fields, but I never really like just thought about making one. And when she spoke about it, then the way she described them, and she was telling me that she loved those blue Californian sky with those poppy fields in the front, then I just saw the sleeve, how I wanted to make the sleeve, and the sort of perspective. And then yes, the rest was just built around this. For the ones that I did before that, then I mean, I love hydrangea, and I just suddenly thought, I would love to make one with a hydrangea in the front. And then, so I made this. And then for the rest, I thought, oh, that would be nice if I put a small garden here. And then I just add elements, and sometimes I paint a whole sleeve before I do the rest, because I like to balance the colors and the elements together. So it's also about visually how I put colors together, and how I balance everything so that it looks quite harmonious as well. So
I'm always just fascinated by people that can visualize things like that, because I struggle so much to visualize something in my mind, whereas you say that you see it and you can see the scene in your head and you just paint what you see. And to me, that's just something that doesn't happen.
I do have a very visual memory. I always have. Like if I remember, if I had an exam and I had to remember things that I had learned, then I would actually have a picture of my sheet with all my notes in my head, and I would be like pointing out which section this whole question is meant to be, and then I would actually see the paragraph with the words in it. So that's how I always worked. So I guess that it's very much the same.
That's amazing, because then you could just be a straight A student with a photographic memory.
If you remember, sometimes I could see the page and I was like, it's this paragraph, but then I couldn't see the words that were in it. So,
and how do you make time for your creativity? Because obviously creating these things take time and energy. So do you kind of allow time to do it and build it into your life? This is something that we were kind of speaking about the other day, was how you kind of strike that work and life balance. And you had some quite interesting insights going back to what you were studying, looking at religion and how we're kind of socially programmed to work.
Yes.
And how we should challenge it.
Yes. to put it in the context, you were telling me that you were feeling guilty of doing nothing. And I told you that was because of your religious background.
I do come from a Protestant family.
The whole of Scotland comes.
Well, we're all doomed.
It's a Baptist background, and some that are more stronger in certain areas. Like I know the Western Isles are quite strong for this whole work ethic. Yes, the Catholic countries are very different on this, and this is why I was telling you that, you know, Italians have their siesta, and the south of France as well, that the siesta is really important, and you will see very often like workers on the worksite having a siesta in the middle of their it is not something that would be considered as shameful, or whereas the more north you go, and the more the work ethic was built into the religion, and you know, redemption through work, and a sort of an austere way of life as well, that you're not allowed to buy frivolous things and spend your money on frivolous activities, if anyone was not particularly religious, this is actually imprinted in the social background. So you would have behavior that would reflect it. So that guilt of not working enough or of taking too much time for yourself or actually taking the time to rest. When you have a long list of things you're supposed to do, then you feel guilty.
Yeah.
And you shouldn't, because yes, it was good in a way, because it sort of gave people a work ethic, and you know, it's something that you needed then also to be able to survive, really, because nobody was going to take your hand and give you food if you couldn't provide it for yourself.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it leaves a strong trace, and it's people need to realize that they are allowed to take the time to rest, even if they have a long list of things that they have to do, because you're not going to achieve this if you're tired and unwell, and you'll be far more productive having had proper time for yourself and sleep. So it's all about finding the balance, really. Which and is that, not easy, I know.
No, and that was on when I was complaining that I felt guilty for doing nothing. It was on Saturday morning, and I was child free, and instead of cleaning the house and working and all the things I thought I should be doing, I was sitting on the couch and I was reading my book, and I did. I just felt really, really guilty for doing that. I always feel really guilty for doing that through the day, and so I never do it. But actually, I mean, I love to write, and if you love to write, you should read more, because it makes you a better writer. So there's absolutely no reason to feel guilty, but it probably is going back to just something that's like built into us, that we have to keep being productive and keep working. I don't think I've had like an afternoon nap since I was probably hungover at university.
Yes.
Even when I had children, people would say, when they were babies, they would say, oh, I'll take them for a couple of hours and you can go back to bed. I said, go back to bed? Why would I go back to bed? I've got laundry to do or whatever. I would never dream of doing that, even if I had like 2 hours sleep the night before.
Yes, that's very, I can see the pattern. I mean, I come from a Catholic background, so there isn't that much pressure on this particular site. I mean, I would feel guilty probably if I had lots and lots to do and I was just like bubbling around, and if I wasn't feeling too tired, if I was just bubbling around, really. But I actually do
that,
sometimes
bubbling around.
I come back and I do have things like I need to clean the kitchen or do the dishes, or and I come back from work and it's been a long day and I just think, well, no, I'll just do it tomorrow morning. Period. I'll just rest, because I also like being a creative person. You are not able to be creative when you're too tired.
No.
It's just blank in your head.
Yeah.
I actually struggle a lot to have any sort of inspiration or just the need to be working on a creative side of things. And I think it's the same for writing. If you are tired and worn out, then
it's impossible.
It's impossible. Yeah. So you actually, in order to be able to do what you do, you need to take those moments for yourself and decide, well, the laundry, everything, the world can wait. I just need my book and my sofa and I will just rest, period.
And actually, you pointed out when we were having this discussion that in the past, when we were driven more by kind of religious doctrine and what we should and should not do, you pointed out that Sunday was a day of rest and that nobody did anything on a Sunday. But in today's society, we tend to work really hard. We'll work the kind of traditional Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, and then at the Saturday you're running around after families, you're doing all the catching up and all the housework, and on Sunday it's the same again, you're working or you're doing something. So we don't have that kind of dedicated day of rest anymore. We've kind of lost it.
Definitely. That was mandatory, that Sunday. I mean, it was that mandatory that even when it was a nice day and that fisherman could go at sea and could make the most of it, then if there was a gale coming or something, then they would actually leave at midnight on the Sunday to be able to pick up the pace or make the most out of it. But they were not allowed in any single way to go out and make the most of the day that could have been quite fruitful, because it was Sunday. And it was, I have to say, probably a good thing, because people would have worked themselves to death, really. Because they needed it for surviving. So And yes, today, this Sunday doesn't really exist. And I mean, people don't realize and think that at the time it was hard, and it was hard. But nowadays there's like children education, there's run to the hobbies, there is
all the shops are open.
All the shops, there is social events, there's community events. Like I sometimes see Shetland families and they spend their entire time just going from school, houseworking, taking the children to places, going to social events to be part of the community, Sunday teas.
Yeah.
And all of this is taking so much of their time, and it's like a constant, there's no really rest in the middle. I can tell that people can exhaust themselves doing this, and so yes, take the time for yourself and take the time to rest, because otherwise it's just automatic pilot and you end up just missing out on quite a lot of things and burning out.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to do it. I'm going to have like a couple of hours every week complete guilt-free on the couch with my book, and that's a promise that I'm going to make to myself to do something that I enjoy.
This is actually an investment in your productivity as well.
Yeah.
So there's no need for guilt, because if you do this, then you are going to be able to work better, produce more, really. And
that kind of leads on to the next question that I have, and it's looking at being self-employed. And being self-employed, you do have to set your own boundaries and allow yourself time. So we've spoken about like carving out that time for yourself to do what you enjoy, but what other things do you think are important for having a successful business?
That's a hard one, because I suppose it depends on also on your, you have to make it work with your lifestyle and your family. And I will likely reply straight away when I see a message, unless I'm like on the ferry or driving or I'm weaving or so I don't really put boundaries, as in I'm not replying after 5 o'clock at night, or because I'm quite happy to do this. But then if I had far more messages, then yes, I would probably put those boundaries in place, because then I would hear the ping all the time and I wouldn't I would just be probably burnt out, because yes, you can't actually stop work.
Yeah, you don't clock in and clock out.
Yes, I'm sometimes jealous of my partner who just goes, yes, he works a lot, but he goes at this time of the morning and he comes back at this time of the night. And if he decides that night he wants to spend in his shed or just play his video games or just do something like this, then that's it for him. He decided he does it, whereas I will still have to manage house stuff, and I will still have to reply to messages, or I forgot, and it's like I'm running sort of three business at the same time, between the weaving and the dolls now and the photography. So I'm constantly juggling about, oh, I need to put more time into this today.
Mm-hmm.
And so yes, I can find it sometimes a bit overwhelming, and I step out sometimes and think, oh right, just tonight I'm just going to watch a nice show and I'm not going to think about all of this.
So it just comes back to giving yourself time, doesn't it?
Yes, and finding a balance that works for you. Also, I think making aware of whoever you live with, your partner, your family, that you know you might actually need their help in helping you manage this, because there's a tendency to think that because you work from home or because you're running your own business, then your time is not is like expendable. You can take the time to go and pick up stuff or to do this, but actually it's time that you take on your work. So if they don't understand this, it can make it more, much more heavier. Whereas if you can communicate really well and say, okay, I can't actually do this, even if I can physically do it, it's still going to be a strain on me. Then it's actually easier. So I would recommend a good communication as well.
I remember about a year ago, I was really, really busy and just tired. And I said to my husband, I said, listen, after tea, I'll wash up if you could like clear the table and dry the dishes. And he kind of looked at me like, what is this? Because he would always just go and sit in his chair while I cleared up. And then like, after a few weeks, he said to me, oh, I see why you asked me to do this. It takes half the time. If there's two of you doing it. And I thought,
few weeks.
So yeah, definitely share the load.
Yes, and I think that yeah, it does. They do have to do it to realize how much time it can take as well, because they sometimes don't quite realize.
No.
And at the same time, I'm trying to project myself also in his shoes, as in, you know, he has to be at 7 at work and he's coming back at 5, and then there's no other choice in between. So I try to be grateful for the freedom that I have to sometimes decide, oh, like right now I don't really feel like being creative or working, so I'll just step back. Whereas he actually has to be there regardless of how he feels. So I think that as long as you can project in each other's shoes and talk about it, then you can find the right middle in between.
Really. Yeah, and it's all swings and roundabouts, isn't it? It's there's pros and cons to kind of both models of working. And listen, Alexa, how can people find you online? So if somebody wants to book a photo shoot, commission a kakashi, or look up your weaving, or just have a snoop around your Instagram page, how can people find you online?
Well, for the weaving, we have a Facebook page under the Shetland Tweed Company, so you can find us on Facebook. We also have an Instagram, but it's not as active. For photography, it's probably best to get in touch with me on Facebook. So it's Odd Puppy Photography. Mm-hmm. So you can find me there and you can message me through Messenger. It's probably the easiest. And then kakeshis, at the moment I'm working on maybe making a website.
Yes.
But it's mainly so far on Instagram. So you can find me in Lex in the North Sea on Instagram.
And I'll put links to all of those in the show notes so that people can find you and get in touch. And finally, for visitors who are coming to Shetland, what would your top 3 recommendations be?
Ooh, that's a hard one.
Sorry.
I would probably say the Muckleroe area, because I absolutely love Muckleroe area. Mm-hmm. Not just necessarily the Stacks, but the whole place, really.
Yeah.
I would say also Noss Cliffs. Go and see the Noss Cliffs, because it's quite incredible to see all those birds.
The gannets.
Yes, and it just feels like entirely different, and like it feels a bit like Jurassic Park. You feel like you're entering Jurassic Park. That's the feeling that I got. Yes. So that would be my second one.
Would you go onto the island and walk to the cliffs, or do you think people are better to see it from the sea from a boat trip?
I would say the boat, because
I'll link the boat trip too, Dane.
Yes. Yes, because you have this feeling of really you're seeing the cliffs from under. So it's spectacular. The size, just the noise, the birds, it's all quite spectacular. So I would definitely say. And then I would probably, I'm quite hesitant between Westerwick area and Unst, because when you go to Unst, then you sort of feel on the edge of the world.
Yeah.
And it has that wild feeling. So I would probably say Unst, but if you get to go west, then go and see Westerwick as well, because it's absolutely beautiful.
So you've chosen 4.
I've chosen 4.
But all 4 are fantastic choices. And yeah, definitely go up to Unst, and as well as feeling like you're on the edge of the world, you can then say that you were at the most northerly beach, the most northerly bar, the most northerly post
shop.
Yeah, you can call them all.
And go and see Muckleflugga, because that's definitely worth, even if you see it from a distance, just go and look at it, because it's absolutely amazing to see it.
That's the most northerly lighthouse.
Yes.
And a fantastic nature reserve too. Again, Harmoness is fantastic for its seabirds as well. Good calls, Alexa. And is there anything else that you would like to add before we say goodbye?
Not really. I think I hope I didn't bore anyone with my research.
No, I love it. I'm absolutely fascinated with all your research and all the kind of spooky stories. I find them fascinating. Thank you for listening. This podcast can only be made possible by my supporters on Patreon, so a huge thank you to all my patrons. If you would like to support me in bringing you more of these shows, you can sign up and become a patron. You will find details about how to sign up in the show notes below, or at www.patreon.com and just search Shetland with Laurie. And remember, you can find more on Instagram and give me a follow at Shetland with Laurie. So thank you once again for listening, and we will see you here next time. And in the meantime, safe and happy travels.
Well, hopefully others will enjoy it as well then.
Well, listen, thank you very much for coming on the show, and we will speak to you very soon.